I'm speaking with Rabbi Michael Lerner. He is the editor of Tikkun magazine and also the author of the book Jewish Renewal, A Path to Healing and Transformation. Hello, Michael.
Hi.
Hi. Did you start the group, Tikkun?
I started Tikkun magazine some 17 years ago, yes.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe the magazine?
Well, it's a progressive, intellectually oriented, spiritually oriented approach to social transformation and healing. Tikkun is a Hebrew word. It means to heal, repair, and transform the world. It started out as the liberal alternative to the voices of Jewish conservatism, but over the years it has evolved into being not just for Jews, but also for anybody from any different, all the different religious traditions, and also people who are atheists or agnostics who recognize that there's something that's needed in politics that we'd roughly say is a spiritual orientation and not only economic transformation, but a spiritual transformation of American society.
Would you describe that as the core vision of Tikkun?
Yes. The core vision, I think, is precisely that, to heal and transform the world, but have the transformation be both an inner and an outer. In other words, we don't believe that you can change the world without changing ourselves and without building an inner life as well as an outer life. So, on the other hand, we're not like the normal spiritual people who say, just focus on your inside, and then later on we'll get to changing the larger society. We believe that economic and political transformation has to go hand in hand with the inner life, but the inner life has to go hand in hand with political and economic transformation.
Rabbi Lerner, can you describe some of your background for us?
Well, tell me where you want me to start.
Well, where were you born?
Oh, well, I grew up in Newark, New Jersey. I went to Columbia as an undergraduate. I got a PhD at the University of California at Berkeley, and I was on the free speech movement's board, or one of the leaders of the free speech movement in Berkeley in 1964, and then chair of Berkeley's Students for Democratic Society from 1966 to 1968. And, well, a long career after that. I was a professor of philosophy, then I became a psychologist, and then I became a rabbi, and also have been the editor of Tikkun magazine.
And you were raised Jewish?
Yeah.
So when did you become a rabbi? How many years have you been a rabbi?
Actually, I've only been a rabbi for 7 years.
7 years. So what brought you to want to start Tikkun magazine?
Well, I was very aware of the conflict that was going on in the Jewish world as more and more people were beginning to move to the right. And so that was one of the things that led me to want to have a progressive voice in the Jewish world. But at the same time, I was also aware of the fact that in liberal and progressive circles, there was a great deal of focus just on economic and political change, but very little understanding of the inner life or the spiritual dimension of human reality, and I wanted to address that as well. So I thought this would be a good way to do both things, and that's why I started it.
How does Tikkun address that? I noticed on your website that you have a Torah commentary, you have a media critique. What are some of the ways that Tikkun addresses that inner life?
Well, we're very much in favor of and have supported people to look at their own inner life and to become involved with some spiritual tradition, whether that's meditation, whether that's a traditional religion, whether that's an alternative spirituality. And then in the magazine itself, we write analyses, some of which are spiritual critiques of the society. What we focus on what we call a politics of meaning. That is, the hunger that very many Americans have for a framework of meaning and purpose that can transcend the individualism and selfishness of the competitive marketplace, connect them to some higher purpose for their life. That hunger for meaning is something that is often manipulated by the right, by the political right wing, by ultra-nationalists and ultra-fundamentalists, because people are often attracted to those communities in part, and that politics in part, because those politics do address the hunger for meaning. They say that there is a framework in which you can find meaning for your life, and it may be a religious framework or it may be a nationalist framework, in which people no longer see themselves as judged entirely by how they do in the economic marketplace. Whereas from the liberal world, they very often hear that the basic message that they're getting is that liberals are about, or liberals and progressives are about inclusion into the larger marketplace. That is, that liberals and progressives focus on the groups that have not been allowed to participate equally in the competitive marketplace. And what liberals and progressives say is, hey, let's everybody get an equal chance. But for a lot of people, having an equal chance to compete in the marketplace doesn't really provide fulfillment. Because even when they succeed, it turns out that what they succeed in doing is maximizing money and power, which is the bottom line of the economic marketplace. So people turn to these right-wing, ultra-nationalist or fundamentalist communities because they're not being judged by how well they do in the marketplace, but by other more transcendent criteria, by something that has a higher value. So what we've been saying is that the liberal and progressive world needs to address that hunger for meaning and purpose as well, to recognize that that the desire for a framework of meaning and purpose that transcends the individualism and selfishness of the marketplace is a valuable desire, but it doesn't have to then be framed in ways that contribute to a reactionary demeaning of others that is often associated with right-wing political movements, ultra-nationalist and fundamentalist movements. Instead, that desire can be connected to a different kind of vision, and our vision is one of a world based on love and caring. And so we say we want a new bottom line in American society, a bottom line of love and caring, or to put it in another way, we're struggling for a new definition of productivity, efficiency, and rationality. Today, efficiency, rationality, and productivity are judged by how much any institution tends to maximize money and power, and we're saying that we want those institutions to be judged by how much they maximize people's capacities to be loving and caring, to be ethically, spiritually, and ecologically sensitive, and to be capable of responding to the universe with awe and wonder and radical amazement at the grandeur of creation. This is what we mean by a spiritual consciousness. It's that the framing reality in those terms. And when you do, when you look at the world from the standpoint of love and caring, awe and wonder, ecological, ethical, and spiritual sensitivity, you see that every institution of American society actually ends up producing the opposite, so that we have a very unproductive, inefficient, irrational society. On spiritual criteria, our institutions do everything they can to undermine spiritual consciousness rather than to foster it. So we think that this is a basis for a very radical critique of American society, but it's a radical critique also of a one-dimensional socialist consciousness.
I'm speaking with Rabbi Michael Lerner, the editor of Tikkun magazine and author of Jewish Renewal, A Path to Healing and Transformation. Rabbi Lerner, you've spoken a lot today about American society. One of the things that Tikkun magazine and the website does is offer some critique of Israeli society and of the conflict in Palestine and Israel. Can you describe the position, your position on the conflict, and we'll talk about strategies for peace as well, but what's your take on it?
Well, our basic take is that there are two very decent peoples who have ended up in opposition to each other, struggling over the same piece of land. Both of them have a legitimate claim on the land. Both, and What has happened has been the inability of either side to see the legitimacy of the other side. And so we've started this organization called the Tikkun Community. And it's an organization that seeks to challenge both, to sort of be a middle path, to challenge both those who believe that the best way to be pro-Israel is to give a blank check to Ariel Sharon on the one hand, or those who think that the best way to be pro-Palestinian is to turn away from any criticism of Palestinian acts of terror against ordinary Israeli civilians, and to participate in demeaning of Israel and making it sound as though Israel is all bad. In our view, both sides have created this mess, and both sides are equally responsible for solving the mess. And the biggest thing we need to get away from is the blaming of one side or the other and making it seem as though one side is the good guys and the other side is the bad guys, because in fact they're both bad guys and they're both good guys.
Now, you have some strategies for peace. Can you describe those?
Yes. Well, we're working to to build a national organization of progressive people who support peace and healing in the Middle East and want reconciliation of the heart, and not just a reconciliation on the policy level. But on the policy level, we're calling for the following. We want an international intervention in the Middle East to go in there and separate the two sides from each other, and to physically separate them and protect each side from the other. So the first thing we want is an end to the violence. We want to stop the killing on both sides. And then we want to see that international intervention impose a final settlement. We say impose rather than start new negotiations, because, of course, when you have negotiations, what it does is it just perpetuates the current situation, because nobody agrees in the negotiations. And meanwhile, the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza continues. So we're in favor of imposing a settlement, and that settlement would involve, number one, an end to the occupation, a return of Israel to the pre-67 borders of Israel, with minor border modifications that would be agreed upon by both sides, that would allow Israel to retain parts of Jerusalem, but meanwhile also allowing the Palestinians to have the capital of their new state in Jerusalem. So that's one part. The second part is we want to see reparations for the Palestinian refugees. A third part is we want to see an end to all violence and end to all terror. We want to see security for Israel, and we're calling for some form of mutual defense pact between Israel and the United States and Palestine and the United States, or to let this new Palestinian state, as well as Israel, both become members of NATO or some other arrangement. In other words, what we're saying is we want to make sure that Israel is secure and protected, and we also want to make sure that the Palestinians are secure and protected. So we want to. We're in favor of a program here that calls for genuine reconciliation, a reconciliation that would allow for a strong, economically viable Palestinian state, and for a strong and safe Israeli state.
Now, Michael, Rabbi Lerner, there are many who do take sides in this conflict, as I'm sure you're well aware. And I want to pose just a few arguments to you that I've heard. Is that okay?
Sure.
How can you say that one side is not responsible? I mean, the Palestinians, they were offered a very generous peace plan by Barak at Camp David, and they walked away. Arafat walked away from the table and did not offer a counteroffer to this plan. So, I mean, the Palestinians are at fault.
Well, actually, there wasn't a very generous offer at all. The offer that was given to the Palestinians was one that asked them to sign as a a final settlement agreement that would eliminate all further negotiation. It would say this is the final arrangement between us. But the arrangement, number one, involved Israel maintaining many of its settlements in the West Bank, and more importantly, it involved Israel having the roads that cut across the Palestinian area, and which would require that people continue to go through checkpoints to go from one area to another of the new Palestinian state. But most importantly, it did the final settlement left the Palestinian refugees, some 3 million refugees, in place without any solution for them, without any plan, without any economic support, and no Palestinian could have possibly signed an agreement of that sort to simply turn their backs on the Palestinian refugees and to sign an agreement saying that they had come to a final solution to the problems that simultaneously was ignoring the Palestinian refugees.
Well, then why didn't Arafat offer a counteroffer to this?
Well, they were actually negotiating, and they continued to negotiate at Taba, which is a town in the area between Israel and Palestine, between Israel and Egypt. And there were negotiations that continued right up to a week before the election. And then Sharon was elected, and he didn't want to continue the negotiations. So it's simply not true that the Palestinians walked away from the negotiations. They continued to negotiate right up until a week before the election. And at that point, it was Barak who called it off. And then when Sharon was reelected, he didn't want to continue negotiations. Palestinians have been calling for negotiations.
Now, you also have the accusation that Arafat is involved with suicide bombings. On the one hand, you hear that these documents that were found by the Israeli army were translated and that they prove that Arafat had some connection. On the other hand, you have journalists like Robert Fisk of the London Independent saying that these translations were incorrect and some parts outright fabrications where he had them translated literally from Arabic, and that this, in fact, was not true. What is the truth on that? Are you aware of this issue?
Well, yeah, I'm aware of the issue, and of course I have no direct knowledge of the documents or what's true or not true of the documents. I'm totally against the suicide bombings and believe that every step that the Palestinians are making a huge error to the extent that they have not accepted a nonviolent strategy following the path of Martin Luther King and Gandhi. I think that that's the best way for them to conduct their struggle. And we have urged them and critiqued them for not going in that direction. Same time, I do want to acknowledge that the Israelis created the Israeli state in 1948 through much in the way of violence and terror against both the English and the Palestinians. So I think it's a little hard for people on that side of the argument to make the case that a moral high ground or to act outraged when, for example, Palestinians seek to get arms for themselves when Israel gets arms all the time, day in and day out. They're getting more and more and more arms. So I don't want either side. I'd like to see both sides disarm. But I do think it's a little peculiar to try to claim that Israel is on the moral high ground and that the other side isn't, and particularly when the acts of violence that Israel is doing on a daily basis in the West Bank have led to far more Palestinians being killed than Israelis have been killed by acts of terror.
Now, I posed a couple devil's advocate type questions on the one side, and now I'd like to ask just a couple on the, quote, other side, if there is two sides. There are those who look at the situation and see the Palestinians as the oppressed, who see them living in the West Bank and Gaza in literally, it seems to be, a prison-type situation, especially in Gaza, where people really can't get out. They're surrounded by soldiers all the time. It's a military occupation, And I've heard many stories people tell that have come back from the Gaza Strip and West Bank, including many Jewish Americans, who talk about how life is just unbearable for Palestinians. And there's an 80% unemployment rate, and there is people going hungry. Even the UN is talking about a malnourishment crisis. There's also almost daily killings of unarmed Palestinians, and, you know, people's homes being demolished, and olive groves uprooted, thousands of trees, farmland being seized with 7 days' notice and no chance to appeal, and tear gas canisters tossed into homes casually is just a way to humiliate. And you hear a lot of stories, as I said, and it leads one to think, well, what hope do these people have? I mean, maybe people strap bombs to themselves because they have lost all hope for, they've seen attempts at a peaceful solution and seen it fail, and they live in such misery that they'd almost rather give their life trying to fight Israel than live under those conditions. What would you say to that argument?
Well, what I would say is that, number one, that the occupation is an outrage. It's a moral outrage and disgusting. And there is no excuse for it, and it needs to end immediately. So all the things that you're talking about are certainly happening. In my view, there's it's just terrible and outrageous. So now the question is, how do you end it? How do you stop that? And what I believe is that the those Palestinians who have not taken a strong nonviolent stance are actually giving aid and comfort unintentionally to Ariel Sharon, because Sharon has convinced the Israeli people that they are in grave danger from these terrorists. And I have to tell you that I know many Israelis who live in fear also and are scared to go out of their home. And I don't see why the answer to the oppression of the Palestinians should be that somebody should feel that they're, if they go on a bus or if they sit in a coffee house, that they're likely to get blown up. The answer to one outrage is not another outrage, and the path to peace is a path of peace. I believe that the civil rights movement in this country and the struggle against England and India were much more successful precisely because they were nonviolent, and that it would be a big, it has been a big mistake for the Palestinian people to have been tolerant of. I don't believe that they have participated. Most of Palestinian people have nothing to do with this violence, but they've still been too tolerant of Hamas and the acts of terror against ordinary Israeli civilians, and I think that that has to stop. And it has to stop, particularly if you care about the Palestinians and you want to end the occupation. You have to realize that these acts of violence are precisely what the Israeli right thrives on and what has given them legitimacy.
Well, some may say they don't support suicide bombings, but how can they call on the Palestinians to halt the violence when the Israelis, on the other hand, the Israeli army is raining so much violence down upon them? And if Palestinians can't go out in the street after curfew without being shot dead by a bullet, well, why should an Israeli be able to sit peacefully on the other side of the border and feel no pain? How can an outsider, you know, an American, for example, call on the Palestinians to stop the violence?
Because we want to win. In other words, you're speaking from some standpoint of people who are looking at this thing without really caring about the Palestinians, I believe. Because if you cared about the Palestinians, you'd want them to win. And the way to win is to end the occupation. I mean, win. That's what I mean by winning, is to end the occupation. And they're not going to end the occupation through acts of violence. So it's you know, you might as well say the same thing about the long history of racism in this country. How could you ask African Americans to be nonviolent in the face of the terrible violence that was being used to suppress them and continue the system of apartheid, I mean, of segregation in the South? Well, the answer is there were African Americans who rallied around the path of the Black Panther Party and pick up the gun as the way to deal with it. Were they morally justified? Well, you could certainly make the case that in relationship to the oppression that people faced in the United States, they might have been morally justified to pick up the gun. But was it smart? No, it was stupid. And what was smart was Martin Luther King and his strategy. So if you care about the outcome and not just about what is, you know, some kind of equivalence, moral equivalence between the two sides, but you care about the outcome, then you don't let your friends or people you care about engage in a self-destructive strategy. That's what.
Rabbi Michael Lerner, do you have time for a couple more questions today?
I have about 2 more minutes.
2 minutes, okay. Why don't we wrap up?
Well, what I wanted to say to you is, you know, that there may be people who want to become part of our movement, of the Tikkun community, and that they should contact us by going to our website, www.tikkun.org, because we're building an organization that's not just for Jews. In fact, the co-chair of this organization with me is Cornel West, an African-American leader who is now teaching at Princeton University. And we're building a national organization of people from every different ethnic and religious community who want to see not only peace in the Middle East, but also want to see a new bottom line in America of love and caring, and want a different kind of progressive politics, a more intelligent and, I think, a spiritually deeper, but also a more radical that is getting to the very roots of what is wrong in our society. And so people should go to that website or call us at 415-575-1200.
Rabbi, one final question?
Yes.
One of the main concerns that you often hear on what you might call the pro-Israeli military government side is the concern for security for Israel. You've talked about a nonviolent path being the answer for Palestinians, because if the violent path is only creating more repression, what about getting security for Israel? I know you've already mentioned some strategies such as bringing in the international community. What is truly going to bring security? What they're saying, Ariel Sharon and the Israeli army, is that they are trying to create security by going in and Operation Defensive Shield, etc., to eliminate terrorists.
Their strategy is as crazy as Hamas's strategy. It's not, you cannot humiliate the Palestinian people into submission, and you cannot terrorize the Israeli people into submission. What you need is a reconciliation of the heart. And the strategy for building security, the only way to peace is a way of peace. And what the Israelis are doing is self-destructive and crazy. It's leading to more and more hatred and more destruction, and that hatred is going to reverberate against Israel. The fantasy of the militarists is always that if they can just squash the other side, everything will be okay. That's what we're seeing now with Bush in the war in Iraq. And by the way, our organization, the Tikkun community, is now talking about creating a national student strike the day after the war in Iraq begins, and doing what we can to oppose that war as well. So the way to peace and security is a way of peace, and you're not going to get it through through militarism.
Some people would think that's a bit naive, to think that you can approach Saddam Hussein or suicide bombers with peace. They would say, oh, well, you'll be crushed if you try to take a peaceful path.
The way to undermine the people who seek violence is to build a world in which there's more love and more generosity and more caring. And if the United States wanted to really isolate and undermine the ability of Saddam Hussein to operate in the Middle East, or of any other terrorists for that matter, the people of Al-Qaeda, all the United States has to do is to engage in a massive rebuilding economically of the Middle East, and a Marshall Plan for the Middle East that gave huge amounts of money to rebuild those societies and to eliminate the poverty, eliminate the hunger, eliminate the inequalities, to stop backing repressive regimes like we back in Saudi Arabia. That would make the America much more secure and make it far less likely that a Saddam Hussein would be able to strike out against anybody. And similarly, in Israel, if Israel were to treat the Palestinians with respect and caring and allow them to have a life that wasn't dominated by oppression and pain and economic deprivation, Israel would be far more secure than it can possibly become through repression.
Thank you so much for your time today, Rabbi Michael Lerner.
Sure, nice to talk to you.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.